Since Mr. Close started off, oh, I know, when I refused to come up and Mr. Sacchina was asked to give the sermon and started up, reminds me one time several years back when the pastor was having a YLU Bible study. And the Bible study was back of the auditorium. There was two glass windows and in the doors so you could see what was going on back there. And I had the song service and he said, "Listen, if I don't make it up there in time, just go ahead and start a sermon." So I'm racing through during the sermonette. I hope he's coming. He didn't come back. So I get up there. I lead a song. No pastor. And I said, "Brethren, for the text of the day, turn to 1 Corinthians 2:9. I have not seen nor ear heard." And about that time, he pops up and starts running. He wasn't about to go through that. Mr. Close started this watery joke thing, so I'll carry on. We do have considerable amount of time. I got up this morning specifically at 5 o'clock to cut down. You can see the number of scriptures I have. It took me an hour and a half to cut this down from 3 hours to 2 hours, and now we've got to even cut it down a little bit more, but we'll get through it. Anyway, this Mennonite farmer was hearing screams from the back of his farm. And he goes rushing up to his pond, and there's this young Mennonite boy floundering around in the pond. He jumps in. He brings him to the shore, and he says, "Young man, how is it you come to fall in?" He says, "I didn't come to fall in. I came to fish." Now, come on. You laughed at Mr. Close's joke. There was this preacher walking from his parish house home to his office in the church a half a block away when he noticed 3 or 4 boys about 10 years old, including his own son, all huddled around in the back of the church around some bushes. And then he was kind of staying out of sight, and he saw one boy take off and run one way and one boy take off and run another, and his boy ran into the house. He let him go. He went into his office, did some work, and when he came back, they were out a little bit farther, and they were all on their knees, kneeling down. So he asked his son later that day, he says, "What was going on?" His son said, "Dad, we found a dead robin in the bushes by the church, and he thought we should give it a decent burial. So Johnny went over and got some cotton. I got a little box, and somebody else went and got something else, and we came back, we dug a hole, and we were going to bury it. But they said, we need to say something before we put this bird in the ground. You're the preacher's son. You pray." The pastor was so proud of his son. He says, "Well, what did you say, my boy?" He said, "Dad, I said, just like you do. In the name of the Father, in the Son, in the Holy Ghost." Before I get into the sermon, here's a human interest deal that I read over the internet. Perhaps some of you have seen this. But it said it's two stories, both true and both worth reading. Story number one. Many years ago, Al Capone virtually owned Chicago. Capone wasn't famous for anything heroic. He was notorious for enmeshing the Windy City in everything from bootleg booze and prostitution to murder. Capone had a lawyer named Easy Eddie. He was Capone's lawyer for a good reason. He was very good. In fact, Eddie's skill at legal maneuvering kept Big Al out of jail for a long, long time. To show his appreciation, Capone paid him very well. Not only was the money big, but Eddie got special dividends as well. For instance, he and his family occupied a fenced-in mansion with live-in help and all the conveniences of the day. The estate was so large it filled an entire Chicago city block. Eddie lived the high life off Chicago mob and gave little consideration to the atrocity that went on around him. Eddie did have one soft spot, however. He had a son that he loved dearly. Eddie saw to it that his young son had clothes, cars, good education. Nothing was withheld. Price was no object. And despite his involvement with organized crime, Eddie even tried to teach him right from wrong. Eddie wanted his son to be a better man than he was. Yet with all his wealth and influence, there were two things he couldn't give his son. He couldn't pass on a good name or a good example. One day, Easy Eddie reached a difficult decision. Easy Eddie wanted to rectify the wrongs he had done. He decided he would go to the authorities and tell the truth about Al Scarface Capone, clean up his tarnished name, and offer his son some semblance of integrity. To do this, he would have to testify against the mob, and he knew that that cost would be great. Undaunted, he went ahead and testified. Within the year, Easy Eddie's life ended in a blaze of gunfire on a lonely Chicago street. But in his eyes, he had given his son the greatest gift he had to offer at the greatest price that he could ever pay. Police removed from his pockets a rosary, a crucifix, a religious medallion, and a poem clipped from a magazine. The poem read, "The clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to tell just when the hands will stop, at late or early hour. Now is the only time you own. Live, love, toil with a will. Place no faith in time, for the clock may soon be still." That's the first story about Easy Eddie. Now another story talks about a man that, it says, World War II produced many heroes. One such man was Lieutenant Commander Butch O'Hare. He was a fighter pilot assigned to the aircraft carrier Lexington in the South Pacific. One day, his entire squadron was sent on a mission. After he was airborne, he looked at his fuel gauge and realized that someone had forgotten to top off his fuel tank. He would not have enough fuel to complete his mission and get back to his ship. His flight leader told him to return to the carrier. Reluctantly, he dropped out of formation and headed back to the rest of the fleet. As he was returning to the mother ship, he saw something that turned his blood cold. A squadron of Japanese aircraft was speeding its way toward the American fleet. The American fighters were gone on a sortie. The fleet was all but defenseless. When he couldn't reach his squadron and bring them back in time to save the fleet, nor could he warn the fleet of the approaching danger, there was only one thing he could do. He must somehow divert them from the fleet. Laying aside all thoughts of personal safety, he dove into the formation of Japanese planes. Wing-mounted 50 calibers blazed as he charged in, attacking one surprised enemy plane, then another. Butch wove in and out of the now broken formation and fired at as many planes as possible until all his ammunition was finally spent. Undaunted, he continued the assault. He dove at planes, trying to clip a wing or a tail in hopes of damaging as many enemy planes as possible, rendering them unfit to fly. Finally, the exasperated Japanese squadron took off in another direction. Deeply relieved, Butch O'Hare and his tattered fighter limped back to the carrier. Upon arrival, he reported in and related the event surrounding his return. The film from the gun camera mounted on his plane told the tale. It showed the extent of Butch's daring attempt to protect his fleet. He had, in fact, destroyed five enemy aircraft. This took place on February 20th, 1942, and for that action, Butch became the Navy's first ace of World War II and the first naval aviator to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. A year later, Butch was killed in an aerial combat at the age of 29. His hometown would not allow the memory of this World War II hero to fade, and today, O'Hare Airport in Chicago is named in tribute to the courage of this great man. So the next time you find yourself at O'Hare International, give some thought to visiting Butch's memorial displaying his statue and his Medal of Honor. It's located between Terminals 1 and 2. So what do these two stories have in common with each other? Butch O'Hare was Easy Eddie's son. So I thought that was pretty cool. I'd relate that to you. It's not the time that a sermon that would take, but it cuts some of the time off, so here we'll go into the sermon. Oh, I didn't take any of the scriptures out. I guess I'm going to have to go 3 hours. What time do we have to be out of here? 4 o'clock, okay. From the time of our first parents, Adam and Eve, to the present day, there's been a penalty for sin. Sin being lawlessness, missing the mark, disobedience, doing what we're told not to do, or not doing what we're specifically told to do. In Genesis 2, we see that God told Adam and Eve that of all the trees of the garden, they could freely eat, except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So, of course, they ate from all the other trees and stayed away from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, right? Sure. Just like your kids stay out of the candy jar or the cookie jar when you tell them, hey, supper time's coming up, you need to stay out of the cookies. No, they didn't. What happened? Satan came along, convinced them that, hey, don't listen to God. What does he know? He can't tell you you can't eat. Listen, you're dressing and keeping this garden. It's your garden. What should God have to say? There's two of you. There's only one of him. You can outvote him. If he tells you you can't do something, he's going to affect your self-worth. Your sensitivities can be destroyed. He can't tell you what to do. That's politically incorrect. What right does he have to threaten you? Why of all the nerve? That's Satan's ploy. That's what Satan did. He told Adam and Eve, you can't arbitrarily let God take charge. You're all equal. So Eve succumbed to the smoke and mirrors of Satan, the devil. She ate of that which God said, do not eat. Then she gave it to Adam. I don't know about you. You kind of wonder, well, why did Adam eat of the fruit? Adam's the only man on the planet. Eve's the only woman on the planet. She's standing there with fruit in her hand, offering it to him, and she is naked. If I were in that situation, I would have probably subjected myself and gone along and ate the fruit too. Later in the cool of the day, walking in the garden, God called for Adam. Adam was hiding. God said, Adam, where are you? Adam said, we heard you coming and we went and hid ourselves because we're naked. God said, who said you're naked? Did you eat from the tree of which I told you not to eat? Adam nodded. It was Eve. My wife made me do it. Quickly, Eve blamed the serpent. So disobedience, sin, then self-justification, blaming others over something as seemingly harmless as eating some fruit. But isn't that the way we do things today? We say, there's a law, but that doesn't apply to me. I can do what I want to. It reminds me of a fellow back in San Antonio. We rolled through a stop sign. He lived on a farm 25, 30 miles outside of San Antonio. He rolled through the stop sign, and I looked at him, and I said, don't you feel bad about doing that? He goes, there was no one coming. I said, I know, but the law is, and it's like the cop who saw a man rolling through a stop sign. And he come up, and he had him roll down the window, and he said, you just rolled through that stop sign. He goes, yeah, I slowed down. He says, yeah, but I'm going to have to give you a ticket. Hey, that's not fair. And the guy in the car really started raising a fuss. That's not fair. I didn't hurt anybody. There was nobody else coming. I slowed down. The cop says, okay, takes out his stick and starts beating him on the head. And he says, now, do you want me to stop or do you want me to slow down? You can't just arbitrarily make up your own rules. And that's what Adam and Eve did. So what was the result? First of all, the serpent was cursed above all the creatures that would crawl on its belly. And then there was enmity against the lady and the serpent. And then another curse for taking the forbidden fruit. The woman would have great difficulty in childbirth. Jot down Genesis 3:16. You can turn there later. In the John Gill Bible commentary, we read, the woman receives her sentence next to the serpent and before the man because she was first and more deeply in the transgression and was the means of drawing her husband into it. unto the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrows, and the conception and pregnancy would be take a toll on her. And this takes in all grief, sorrows, disorders, pains from the time of pregnancy unto the birth, such as nausea, loathing for food, dizziness, pains of the head, pains of the teeth, fainting, swooning, danger of miscarriage. It just goes into this great lengthy description of childbirth. And I picked this, John Gill wrote this in the mid-1700s, because of the horrendous picture that it paints. I'm sure none of you ladies that have had children ever had any problem having childbirth, right? I know we had children. I didn't have any problems. I didn't. But my poor wife, our first child, Kimberly, was born shortly after the Day of Atonement. For some of you old timers, you remember back in the 60s when we came around to a fast day or the Day of Atonement, we were to afflict with a big emphasis on afflict. We didn't start at sunset when the holy day starts. We're supposed to start at noon, have a light lunch, then suffer all afternoon, go through the whole next day. Well, that's what we did. Pam fasted, no water, no food. We were going to drive from Buffalo to Jekyll Island, Georgia. We're going to stop in Penyan with my mother, stay overnight, and then make the trip down. We had another gentleman with us, and an elderly gentleman who was in his 80s, who had just been baptized for 6 months, and was going to his first Feast of Tabernacles, and we're all ready to go to Jekyll Island, figuring my wife had another month before she was to deliver. We were wrong about that. She went into labor. We had to make a decision. Are we going to try to find a doctor in Penyan? Are we going to go back home? So we gather up this elderly gentleman, the other fellow that was traveling with us. We went back to Buffalo, where we had our doctor already set up. Well, Pam labored for 3 days. The doctor finally walked out because our daughter was coming breech, and everybody else was gone to the feast. I called Mr. Antion. He was in South Carolina at the time, having services that day. And I said, what are we going to do? He said, listen, there are about 8 other pregnant ladies that are going to have their babies, and this doctor is supposed to say, don't offend her. If she wants you to go to the hospital, go to the hospital. So I said, okay, we went to the hospital. For 20 years afterwards, every time we came in contact with this elderly lady doctor, she insisted that Pam gave birth to Kim, naturally, normally, the baby turned around because of the ride in that old Cadillac to the hospital. She didn't realize that there were 2 churches praying that Kim wouldn't come breech. So that is one of the situations with disobedience. And on top of the childbearing curse, what else did God levy on woman from that point forward? Again, in Genesis 3:16, God tells the woman that her desire would be to a husband and he shall rule over her. And to Adam, God said, curse would be the ground. Thorns and thistles would come up. When you're trying to have crops, we have to go through all kinds of pesticides because of the bugs and herbicides to kill the weeds because of mankind's not following directions. And if all that wasn't enough, Adam and Eve were driven out of this beautiful garden that God had given them. And an angel with a flaming sword to stand guard so they couldn't get back in. What does all of that have to do with us? So you're scratching your head and say, yeah, please tell me, what does that have to do with us? Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Starting in verse 9. When you come into the land which the Eternal your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who conjures spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, one who calls upon the dead. Verse 12, for all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God drives them out from before you. You shall be blameless before the eternal, your God. You shall be blameless. The King James renders it, you shall be perfect, without spot, undefiled, upright. Turn over to 1 Kings chapter 8. Verse 61. Let your heart, therefore, be loyal to the eternal our God, to walk in His statutes and keep His commandments as at this day. He wants us to have a loyal heart, to be obedient, to be loyal to Him. And in 2 Chronicles chapter 16, 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9. For the eyes of the Eternal run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show Himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to Him. In this you have done foolishly, therefore from now on you shall have war. So when the laws are broken, when they're not loyal to the Eternal God, then punishment. The phrase heart is loyal to Him could well be rendered a wholehearted, undivided devotion. Do you really think that God is totally pleased with us in all that we do? Just think about that for a minute. In your time of quietness, when you are thinking and totally honest with yourself, do you think that God is just totally happy and pleased with everything that we do? I can't answer that for any of you. You can't answer it for me. But we can answer it for ourselves. Deep down in the innermost of our being, do we think God is pleased? The God that says, I'd rather have obedience than sacrifice. The God that says we should love Him with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, all our strength. The God that says you shall be perfect with the eternal your God. Do you think that God is entirely pleased with everything we do? I can tell you right now, I don't think a day goes by that I don't anger, frustrate, annoy our Father in heaven. And on a daily basis, I repent for those things. But you know what it might end up? It's like He told Adam and Eve, you shall surely die. We could still end up receiving that punishment for lawlessness, missing the mark, and our sin. You know, in 1995, we took a stand. We decided that we weren't going to follow those that taught heresy. We did what we had to do to continue in the faith once delivered. We were staunch. We were united against those that would pervert God's word and teach us things that were false. We worked together. We put aside our small differences for the good of the entire church. And I think at that time, God looked down and He was pleased with us. But I think as time goes on, or went on, we started to get aggravated with those that didn't agree with us 100%. And people got aggravated with us because we didn't do things just the way we should have. I think God looked down at that time, even though we weren't perfect. We did what we thought was right in His sight. We stood for true doctrine, for righteousness, and we did what we could to the best of our human ability. But that's where the rub is. We're human. We're not going to be perfect. No one's perfect. Things started to bog down. We didn't see other people's ideas and ways because if they didn't agree with us, we didn't accept it. And you know, it's not only in the United Church of God that these things happen. The whole world around us is in conflict. The place where we meet in San Antonio, it's in a Messianic, Jewish Messianic synagogue. That congregation has as its founder and leader one of the world's renowned Hebrew scholars. He travels back and forth to the Middle East. He's in Jerusalem. He teaches all over the country. He gives seminars. Even with that influence, their church split right down the middle. The people just, and why do these splits come? Who could not name why the Barna, who gives these polls, said the major reasons why churches split, what would you think the answer should be? It should be, if somebody leaves a church, it should be because of doctrine. But it rarely is. It's because of finances. It's because of buildings. It's because of personalities and leadership. That's why churches split. In the greater scheme of things, people splinter off for any number of reasons. Different groups are formed. And then many just stay home. That's not the answer either. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10. Very familiar passage. Starting in verse 19. Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. Someone would have to be absolutely blind not to see that the day is approaching. The end times is coming on us rapidly. World conditions, the upsets in governments, the problems with the weather, all of these things are culminating, and we're worried about little trifle things. As one evangelist used to say, we major in the minors. We get all worried about things that aren't important, and the things that are important, we don't take as seriously as we should. I think we've lost track and lost sight of something very important. Turn, if you would, to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Verse 19. Breaking in the middle of a thought here. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. We aren't ours. We don't have the right to make decisions like staying home and not fellowshipping. We don't have that option. God bought us with a price, the price of Jesus Christ's life, his shed blood. We are his slaves, his servants. We don't have the right to go around and decide what we're going to do on our own. Looking down at chapter 7, starting in verse 22, for he who is called and the Lord, while a slave, is the Lord's freed man. Likewise, he is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. So back in the time when indentured slavery was extant, if someone was a slave and came to know Christ, they were freed because they knew the truth. But if they were freed and called, they were Christ's slaves. So at either way, we're Christ's slaves. We don't decide to just stop coming. It's not our choice. It's not our option. Turn to Psalm 116, verse 16. the 116th Psalm. David says, O Lord, I truly am your servant. I am your servant, the son of your maidservant. You have loosed my bonds. So David knew that he was a servant. He was a servant of God. And then compare with Colossians 4:12. Colossians chapter 4, verse 12. Epaphras, who is among you, a servant of Christ, greets you, always laboring fervently for you in prayers, that you may stand perfect and complete in the will of God. There's ample evidence, brethren, that we are to be bond slaves and servants to Jesus Christ. A servant does his master's bidding. A servant doesn't decide what he's going to do on his own. A servant doesn't just go off and say, hey, I'm going to meet over here, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. We are called and put in the body where Christ wanted us. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 16. We can't just go off and do our own thing. Every action, every thought, every word, we're responsible for to God. We can't just be loose cannons doing what's right in our own sight. Proverbs 16, verse 2, said, all the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the eternal weighs the spirits. Commit your works to the eternal, and your thoughts will be established. The Eternal has made all things for Himself, yes, even the wicked for the day of doom. Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Eternal. Though they join forces, none will go unpunished. In mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity, and by the fear of the Eternal, one departs from evil. Whoa. When a man's ways please the Eternal, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. We can't just go off and do our own things. Can't have thoughts that are just our own ways, our own thoughts. Jot these scriptures down. Proverbs 3:7. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Proverbs 12:15. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes. And then Proverbs 30, verse 12. There is a generation that is pure in its own eyes, yet it is not washed from its filthiness. They think they're right. They think they're great. They think they're going to do the good thing. But God said they're still in their dirtiness. They're still in their filthiness. Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah 5, verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, and prudent in their own sight. So that's the end result of the ones that think they're so wise. God says, woe to them. There's a punishment. There's a just reward coming. You shall surely die. Many, it seems, have forgotten. We don't just choose to be here. We didn't wake up one morning and say, oh, speaking of the other hall, there's a nice church down there on Maple. It's got a big parking lot, nice kitchen, sanctuary is beautiful, a little meeting room on the back. I think I'll go to church there. We didn't make that decision, did we? Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. First Corinthians chapter 1, starting in verse 9. God is faithful, by whom you were called into the fellowship of His Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing and there be no divisions among you, that you may be perfectly joined together in the same mind and the same judgment. For it's been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, I'm of Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul? God's telling us he doesn't want us to be divided. But the thing that I'm trying to drive home here is that we were called. We were called. We were invited. We weren't just good people that happened to find God. I mean, I've heard people say, I've been looking for God all my life. Doing the wrong things, going to the wrong church. God called us here. Turn over to 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Starting verse 13. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 13. But we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification and by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which he called you by our gospel, for the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle. Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself and our God and Father, who has loved us and given us everlasting consolation by good hope, by grace, comfort your hearts and establish you in every good work and word. God called us. We didn't choose God. Brethren, God called us, gave us an invitation to be here. He wants us to be all on the same page. He wants us joined in mental unity when it comes to his word. This is pretty well illustrated by athletics. Let's consider a football game. You know, to the untrained eye, a football game, you watch the players running around doing different things. It looks like it just happenstance. It looks like it's helter-skelter. These guys are running all over the field. I remember watching a college game at a friend's house one year. I was probably 15, 16 years old. I went over to Bob's house. His mother is ironing in the hallway where she can kind of keep her eye on the game. She wasn't an aficionado of football. She didn't care what was going on. But she made a remark. She says, this just doesn't seem fair. Bob says, what are you talking about, Mom? This is back in the time of black and white television. She says, the black jerseys, they got a bunch of guys. The white jerseys got a bunch of guys. But the ones in the striped jerseys only have half as many. This is not fair. That is an untrained eye. She's looking at the officials and saying, well, they don't have as many. And then she made the comment, you know, if they had two footballs out there, they wouldn't be fighting over that one. That's an untrained eye. But athletic events have to be governed by rules. That way, the biggest, baddest guy doesn't come out, rip the helmet off somebody, pound him in the ground, take the football, and win the game. No, we need rules. We need to follow the rules. Everyone on the team has to cooperate. There's no I in the word team. No one's alone. The team works together. They go to practice, so everybody seems to know what the other guy is doing, okay? Somebody has to call the plays. Generally, it's the coach or offensive coordinator. Sometimes the quarterback, if he's well-versed enough in the game and had enough experience, can call his own plays. Most of them have the freedom to call an audible at the line of scrimmage. You get up there and you're going to run a play right here and their biggest, baddest guy is standing there. You go, huh, maybe that hasn't worked the last six times. Maybe I'll try something different. That's a possibility too. But all of this, so a team can be together with the same mind, the same judgment, working together, as Paul spoke of in 1 Corinthians 1 that we just read. The teams that successfully work together, that buy into the coach's theories, generally win games. By way of analogy, we follow rules. God's rules. They're all laid out for us. All we have to do is get familiar with them. Somebody calls the plays. God, Jesus Christ, call the play. We practice. We practice this way of life. We work together. We love one another. Unfortunately, some don't follow the rules. In football, they get a flag. I know personally the starting quarterback or starting center on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Jeff Fain. He was a nephew of a good friend of mine. We met him a couple times. I know his mother. And he writes home to his mother that when we get flagged, now I don't know if this is true for every team, but on his team, when they get a penalty, they get docked in their pay. And it's substantial, like $5,000, $10,000 when they get a flag in a football game. Now, that's N-O-T, it's a three-letter word. It shouldn't be this difficult. It's not as bad as you shall surely die, but a penalty can be difficult for a team if it puts them back once the guy gets a penalty in football. Could be costly to the player as well. Rules are freedom. Rules are predictable. It's what gives us the freedom. If a defensive lineman crashes through the line and smacks the quarterback upside the head violently, if the official sees it, he knows every time he's going to draw a flag. It's a penalty. Rules don't stifle creativity and individuality, but you have to express them within the limits of the rules. That's a challenge. Anybody can go off and do their own thing if there's no rules. But if there's rules, it's a challenge to be creative and individual within those rules. I remember as a high school quarterback, we had one opposing team that had a humongous line, and our coach would keep sending in plays. He'd had one guard that would go out, call a play, and send another guard in with the following play, and this would keep going on and on and on. Well, the coach called a play to run this certain area, and I'm thinking to myself, this hasn't worked the whole game, so I'm going to try something myself. So I got in the huddle with the guys, and I said, okay, we're going to try this. Going to send Kurt, you go to the flag. At each corner of the football field, there's a flag. And I'm going to send Stuart to post. That's where the goal post is. Another guy's going to go down 12 or 15 yards and cut it a slant. I'm just going to throw up the ball as hard and long as I can, and we'll see what it does. Somebody says, well, what play is that? Huh? I said, that's going to be the home run ball. We're going to win. We're going to score on this play. It backfired. Probably didn't even get the throw off. Our line couldn't hold the defense away from us. So we had to punt, and I was the punter. The guard goes off, and the next guard comes back on. Well, the guard that went off, the coach went over here and said, what did Cooper call on that play? Real proud. The guy goes, home run ball, coach. I come off. The coach calls the timeout. I come off the field. He grabs my helmet, yanks my head, and about this far away from my face, he's saying, Cooper, we don't have a home run ball in our playbook. I mean, we had to memorize. This was 45, 46 years ago. We had to memorize, you know, like 100 different plays. And as a quarterback, I was supposed to know where everybody else was going as well. Just as an aside, 2 years ago when we were up, I got to visit Coach Ballard. He'd been in a severe car accident in South Carolina and nearly died. But he lives in the hometown. He lives in Dundee. And my buddy says, let's go visit Coach Ballard. And I said, well, sure. That'd be great. I haven't seen him in 45, 46 years. So he called his wife. He said, is John accepting visitors? He said, for a little while. He can stay up for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. We get to the door, knock on the door. Coach Ballard comes to the door. Stuart, how you doing? You're doing good. He looked at me. Who's this young man? Stuart says, well, don't you recognize him? He says, say a couple words, young man. And you got to understand, this guy was a history teacher, football coach. He's a little All-American for University of Vermont. He was like a Hitler. real dark beard. In the assemblies at 3 o'clock, he already looked like he hadn't shaved for 3 days. I mean, he's just a man's man. And now he's nothing but an 85-year-old, shriveled up, you know, and poor guy, memory was a little bit lax. And he says, well, say a few words, young man. I said, home run ball, coach. Tom Coover. I would have thought it'd be a normal experience for everybody to go make up their own plays, but apparently under Coach Ballard's regime, not many people did it because he remembered me. Our rule book has to be in our hearts and our minds. The principles of this word. And like a football game, when a rule is broken, the penalty comes around. You shall surely die. I better check my time here. What are we at? 4 o'clock, you say? Speaking of rules, remember the big sports news at the basketball season last year, college level? Brigham Young's Brandon Davies broke the rules. Now, in Brigham Young, they have to sign a code of ethics that all the players are going to adhere to in order to be on the team. Well, he and his girlfriend got it on, and he got feeling guilty about it, and he went to the officials, and they actually suspended him, which was the right thing to do. But the newscasters, the following few days, are going, well, I think in terms of our modern thinking that the college should have been more liberal and not have taken such a stand against this young man because it diminished their chances of going very far in the college playoff. Well, they did the right thing. But what the newscaster wanted us to do is lower the bar. Let us do whatever we want to do. If public opinion goes along with it, let's just do it. I mentioned to someone what I was going to speak on today, that there's a penalty for sin. And then I don't think God is extremely happy with us. And all this division that's been in the church, I think God has removed some of his blessings from us. Because I think sometimes I told Mr. Close a couple weeks ago that sometimes we take ourselves too seriously. But I think also, on the other hand, sometimes we don't take God seriously enough. I don't think we put enough stock in doing exactly what God says we should do. And I don't think God was extremely happy with us. I think we've lost some of the desire to obey God the way we should. Actually, what I'm saying now is a politically correct version of what I told the person. And if anybody knows me real well, I don't have a big lot of intention to be politically correct. And if that comes as a shock to you, think about what Christ called the political leaders of his day. White and sepulcher, hypocrites. What I did say to that someone is the church is sick and we need to get on the ball. And they said, what are you going to do? Take us back to the 50s and 60s? Which is indicative of the problem. We don't want to go back to a time that's restrictive. Well, I don't mean be restrictive or people are trying to run our lives. What I want to take us back to is the first century. The church of the apostles. The church that Jesus Christ built, taught the apostles. The apostles taught things. But if you go through the books of the New Testament, Corinthians, Ephesians, the people didn't do it. They were taught it, but they didn't do it. And the errors of the church, they get their various punishments and corrections because they didn't. So we've degenerated, I think, and we've lost a lot of what God has revealed to us early on. That goes right along with what the sportscaster was saying. We ought to lower our standard of ethics to meet the approval of the majority. You know, the law that was just recently passed in New York State makes us one of the 6 states in this country that allows a man to marry a man. That's what happens when you follow what the ethics of the majority is. It's not right. It's not what God says. That's what seems right in the thinking of a man. A year or so ago, in a press conference, President Obama said, we don't have to be number one. You ever watch a college game where the people come running out, hey, we're number two? Number two is like kissing your sister. Why do you play the game? Why do the horses run the race? To win. Not that we want to be better than somebody else, but we want to be the best we can be. Let's do like the army. Be the best we can be. That's why we have problems in the country. That's why we have problems in the world. That's why we have problems in the church. We don't want to be the best we can be. I was working a job in Alamo Heights outside of San Antonio. High scale, old oil money homes. You take a $150,000 home, a nice medium home like here, someplace with a couple of acres, a nice, fairly modern $150,000 home. You put it in Alamo Heights and it's $450,000. Same house, same condition. It's an upscale place. So I'm working on this house. Go into one of the son's bedrooms. Now, when I was working there, the son probably was 19, 20 years old, off to college. But I noticed in his bedroom, all the way around on every wall, a connecting shelf about 12 inches deep, loaded with trophies all the way around that room. Baseball trophies, tennis trophies, golf trophies. I thought, wow. This guy's got, I must have heard of this guy. So I started checking around. As it happened, I did work for an architect that happened to coach these boys in Little League when all these trophies were passed out. And I said, Mark, this guy must be some real college standout. He must be going to go to the pros. He's scratching his head and he goes, well, why do you say that? I said, he's got all these trophies. He must be some superior athlete. Says, Tom, they get a trophy every time they show up. I go, what? Yeah. They come to a practice, they get a little trophy. They go to a game, they don't even have to play, they get a little trophy. And I'm thinking, you know, that's just all kinds of wrong. What message does that send to a kid? Oh, you don't want to hurt their little psyches. You got to make them feel valuable. Well, now, wait a minute. What happens when they get to be 25 years old? They've been handed trophies, certificates, diplomas, no kid left behind. Comes in to get a job. I'm sorry, you're unqualified. Oh, but I'm here. Give me a job. Or worse, he gets hired and figures he doesn't have to do anything. I want my paycheck. I was here all week. Life doesn't work that way. Unfortunately, back in worldwide, the YOU, the director of YOU, the later one, son was not athletically inclined, had hurt feelings because he was never put in games, and they started changing the rules that we wanted none of this competitive spirit, we wanted everybody to get equal opportunity to play. And I told our pastor, I said, for the basketball then, you might as well take the baskets off the board, take the backboards down, run up and down the court and throw the ball against the wall and don't keep score. But what's the point of sports? You can learn a lot of good lessons with righteous competition. You do the best you can against the defenses that are put out there without fouling, within the rules. They didn't see it that way. We didn't want to hurt little Johnny's feelings. So I'm working with coaches, little tykes like my grandson Mason here. And they've got to put all these kids in because they don't feel right. They feel like they're thwarted if they don't get to play. Mason, fortunately, is one of the better ones, and he's a star. That's because he's got the Cougar gene in him. Am I embarrassing you, Mason? Oh, not? You want me to keep going? Want me to tell them how really good you are? But that's the society we're in. We lower the standard so low that everybody's a winner. But life doesn't work like that. We feel if we get do the minimum, we can get by. As a little assignment, read Matthew 25, the parable of the virgins, the parable of the talents. I don't think God indicates that you just do enough to get by. You do your best. Now, I think God marks on a curve. I don't think he marks me the same way he might mark somebody else, because somebody else might have a lot more strength in some area than I do. I may have more strength in some area than that other person does. So God's not going to judge me the exact same way on righteousness, because it's right here in his word. He'll do that. But as far as what, you know, when the parable of the talents, when one guy got increased his talents tenfold, he was given more, fivefold more. But the one who wouldn't increase it, he was told he was unprofitable. We settle all too often for mediocrity. We've lowered the bar. We've lowered God's standards. And then, you know, I think if you're honest with me, you might not want to hear it, but you'd have to agree that we've been sick. We have lowered the standards. You might say, "Yeah, I think we're doing pretty good, sir, and you're out of line." Well, then let's just go through some scriptures and see what God says about certain things. Now keep in mind, I'm not pointing my finger at you. I'm not pointing my finger at anybody in leadership of either the churches that broke away or our church. I'm pointing the finger at me as well. I'm indicting myself. I have been in the church for 46 years, and I go through periods of times where I just go through the motion. You know, you do certain things because they're a habit, because you've been taught to do them. Sometimes we're not as vibrant. We're not on fire. We're not alive. And I think God's going to hold us accountable for that. I'm looking at myself as you should look at yourself. See where we've been sick. You know, some diseases are so subtle. People go on thinking everything is all right. All of a sudden, they've got a pain in their stomach. They go to the doctor, get ripped open, and they're full of cancer. They didn't even know it. That's what happens spiritually. Sometimes we're sick. We don't even know it. There's no visible signs. God sees them. Sometimes we deceive ourselves. Let's see in some areas where perhaps we've lowered the standards. Turn to Exodus chapter 16. I'll try not to say too much. I'll let God's word say it. And we just have to. Now, I'm going to need this. Exodus chapter 16. Starting in verse 25. We'll start in verse 23. Then he said to them, "This is what the Eternal has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath, a rest, a holy Sabbath to the Eternal. Bake what you'll bake today, boil what you'll boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." So they laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Eternal. Today you will not find it in the field." And you know what we're talking about, the manna. God tested his people. And to those skeptics that think that the commandments weren't in effect before that, why would he say, "How long will you before you remember my Sabbath?" Verse 25, Moses said, "Eat, today is the Sabbath of the Lord, you will not find it. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none." Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Eternal said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws?" Verse 29, "See, for the Eternal has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the Sabbath. That's all pretty self-explanatory. Exodus chapter 20. But see, here's the rub. We know these things. We've been around for years. We can quote them. We can turn to scriptures in our sleep. But how often do we kind of lower the bar? There's always a reason. There's always an excuse that we can do something other than the way God expects us to do things. Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, sanctified, separate. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Eternal made the heavens and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Eternal blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it. Look up hallowed. Find out what it means. Think, do we hallow God's Sabbath day? Exodus 31, verse 12. Exodus 31, verse 12. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal who sanctifies you. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whosoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest, holy unto the Eternal. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall be surely put to death. Therefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout the generations as a perpetual covenant. It's a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. In 6 days, the Eternal made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And when he made an end of speaking with him on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses 2 tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written with the finger of God. Do we hallow God's Sabbath? Do we keep it like the instruction book says? Isaiah 58, verse 13. Isaiah 58, verse 13. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Eternal, honorable, and shall honor him. You know, sometimes we don't think about it, but we show honor to God how we keep the Sabbath, or in some cases, perhaps dishonor in the way we keep the Sabbath. The holy day of the Eternal, honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words. Then you shall delight yourself in the Eternal, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Eternal has spoken. Another topic that we can judge ourselves as to how we've lowered the bar is husband-wife relationships. Back to Genesis 3:16. You know, God said that the husband shall rule over the wife. Now that's a mighty sore topic sometimes, isn't it? I have to laugh. My wife's dad remarried after how many years was he married to your mom? After she died, he remarried. And in the ceremony, the ministers went through the traditional ceremony and he said, and you, Jane, promise to honor and obey your husband. Jane, being a little bit hard of hearing, said, what? When the word obey came up, she goes, and we got this on the film. We weren't able to come up, but they sent us a video. Do you promise to honor and obey Ken? What? That's fighting words. And she was ready to walk out, I think. I mean, her whole composure. She just looked dazed at the rest of the service. I mean, that one came as a shock to her. I mean, she was a bus driver, school bus driver for years, and she was a man's man, but she was a woman's woman. No, she was a manly woman. And she did not like the idea that she might have to obey. But jot down Esther 1:20, verse 22. Even in an unconverted Gentile nation, they made a decree that the man should be the head of the home. Any of you remember Ralph Cramden and the Honeymooners? Ralph Cramden would be mad at his wife, Alice. He goes, "Alice, I'm the king around here. I'm the king of the castle. You're nothing." Alice goes, "Ralph, let me get this right. You're the king. I'm the king. And I'm nothing. You're nothing." She goes, "All right, Ralph, you're king over nothing." "Okay, Alice. Pow, zoom, off the moon." You know, unfortunately, that's the way a lot of husbands rule their wives. And that's not the case. 1 Peter 3, verses 2 through 6, Ephesians 5:33, very familiar passages. Take a look at those. Read them. Practice them. I haven't even touched on government and won't. But there's another subject that I feel needs revival in God's church, and that's faith. Turn to Luke 18. Book of Luke, chapter 18, verse 8. "And I tell you that he will avenge them speedily," speaking of Christ. "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" Now, he doesn't say, "Save my little flock over here in the United Church of God. Will there be faith anyplace else on the earth?" He says, "Will I find faith?" And that lumps us in, too. Now, we can be obedient to certain things. We can do a lot of things good. But we also need to have faith. Something that I hammer on every once in a while in San Antonio, Hebrews 11:6, something, again, we're all familiar with. We can probably quote it. Hebrews 11, verse 6. "But without faith, it's impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him." He doesn't say it's going to be hard to please God without faith. He doesn't say it's going to be difficult without faith to please God. It says without faith, it is impossible to please God. Jot down James 5:14. We're all familiar with that. James 5:14. "Any sick among you, call on the elders of the church." And then what does it say? "And the prayer of the faith will guide the hands of the surgeon." Doesn't say that. It says the prayer of the faith will heal the sick. Christ said, "I don't know if I'm going to find faith." God, one of his very names is, "I am the God who heals you." I rarely anoint anyone without mentioning Psalms 103:3. And one of the benefits that we have for obeying God is he forgives our sins and heals our diseases. God says, "I'm a jealous God." He's not going to just turn over one of the very things that he is named after to the pharmaceutical laboratories and to the medical profession. Now, I'm not going to stand up here and say you can't go to doctors. There's things we need to go to doctors for. There's certain laws that are in extant that if you don't go to a doctor, I've told my wife, I said, "You know, for a couple years on and off, I've had high blood pressure. I get chest pains and palpitations." And I told her, I said, "If I go down sitting in here, my computer someday, go get in the car and go to the mall. Come back in 3 or 4 hours." She goes, "No, they'll know that you've died right then and there, and they'll blame me. Well, that's true. I mean, there's certain things that you have to because of the laws of the land. A couple years ago, my oldest daughter, she's progressively getting worse and worse bouts of poison ivy, and she got to the point where her throat swelled up. She flashed from her feet to her head. She was just broke out all over. And my son-in-law called me and said, "What am I going to do?" I said, "I'll send a cloth, but you better get her in and have a doctor take a look at it, because if you don't and something happens, you are responsible." That doesn't negate the fact that God is healer. That doesn't negate the fact that you trust God, but you got to use your head. I mean, you either got to be willing to, okay, this is what happened, and now I'm responsible. I remember Governor Ted Armstrong used to say, "You can break whatever laws you want to, as long as you humbly and respectfully say yes, sir, and pay the penalty that's exacted." You know, like speeding or rolling through a stop sign. You want me to stop, or you want me to slow down? Faith is, we need for jobs, for our income, for situations to improve, better relationships, healing, whatever. I don't think across the board we have living faith the way we need it. And it's not something you work up. It's something that because you're close to God, because you're obedient to God, you understand that God can fix it. Too often we come up against a problem and we can't wait for the solution because we're in a now society. We need now. We need drive-up coffee places. We don't want to go in and wait for our coffee. We need everything instant. We need satisfaction and gratification now. So when it doesn't get fixed, we'll fix it ourselves. And then we pay the penalty for it later. Faith is a gift from God. We need to be diligently seeking Him, His will, in our lives. Understand that the problem isn't bigger than God. It's not something that He doesn't know about. Whatever's in our life, God can fix it. We can have faith that God will take care of it, that He can heal it. Whatever it is, He can take care of it. Another situation in our lives that I think we're far, far, far from doing things pleasing to God, that's in Matthew 7. Take a look at Matthew 7. Matthew 7, verse 1. We're getting down to the end of this, and didn't take anywhere near the length of time I thought it was gonna. Of course, I cut half of it out. Matthew 7, verse 1. "Judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Here, let me remove the speck out of your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye?" Picture this. Graphically, close your eyes and picture a friend having a little teeny tiny speck in their eye. And you got this great big beam, and you're going over here, "Here, let me get that. Whoa, I can't get very close. I got this beam in my eye. I can't. Wait a minute. Here, I'll take the speck." You ever get something stuck in your eye? I know you did. You want somebody that can't see very clearly come and start digging around and take it out of your eye? No. And that's what God's saying here. How do you think you've got the right, when you can't even see clearly because you got this plank, this beam sticking out of your own eye, and you're going to correct somebody else? And again, not pointing the finger at you. I do the same thing. How do you say to your brother, "Let me remove that little bitty teeny tiny speck out of your own eye," when this board's in your own? Hypocrite. First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. Romans 14. Romans 14, verse 4. "Who are you to judge another man's servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. Was on a job. One of the co-workers would come in, supposed to start at 8 o'clock, 5 after 8, 10 after 8, every day. Then when he got there, he'd go to the four or five other guys, and he'd be talking. He'd go, you know, everybody's starting to work, and he'd be talking to this one. Nothing related to work, but he'd be jabbering about this. How was your evening? What'd you do over the weekend? And then he'd go to the next. I'd be looking at my watch. 20 or 30 minutes would go by before he'd even get a brush in the paint and do anything. And it started to wear on me. And at this point, I wasn't the boss, so it wasn't my particular job to say anything. But it ground on me. I'd come home and I'd mention it to Pam. Next day, 5 minutes, 10 minutes after 8, come in, do the same thing. The boss would leave, and he would fiddle around and manipulate other people so he could do the easiest things, and it would just, and it kind of kept hitting me for the last 2 weeks. Who am I to judge another man's servant? The boss knows him. See, throughout the year, he and the boss work alone together. All right, so I can justify this by saying maybe he's a great deal of help to the boss when I'm not around. Maybe when there's five or six of us working in the summer, he's resting a little bit. And he's taking it a little bit easier, okay? But it's not my call. And that's so hard for us sometimes. We get to the point where we're the authority on everything. We're going to straighten out everybody else. We're going to do... I mean, what I feel is I am busting my tail. And this guy's loafing half the time. Well, when I got my paycheck this week, I got a $70 little extra kick. So I figured, see, now if I'd opened my mouth, I would have made an enemy with the boss. Invariably, the boss might have said something to the guy, so there'd be friction there. It's just so much easier to swallow it. Who am I to judge another man's servant? He's working for this guy. It's up to this guy to see what he's doing, not up to me. There's several things that we can work on. Not judging. How we keep the Sabbath. Husband-wife relationships. Faith. Think about these things. See if we have lowered the bar in our own lives. Or if we've got the same standard that God has. Brethren, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. We are all links in the greater church of God. If we're weak, the chain is weak. We need to make sure we don't lower the bar. In many ways, I think the church has been sick. I think it's coming out of that. I think if you have courage to be honest with yourself and look into God's word, search out his will, I think you too see, as I've seen in myself, there's places where we can raise the bar, where we can do it according to God's standards, not according to the world's standards. They have no standards. We don't want to water things down. We don't want to lower the bar. We don't want to settle for mediocrity. But there is good news, okay? As you look through the Bible, you see faithful men, Noah, Abraham, Jacob, David, Moses. See faithful women like Sarah, Rahab. All these people were human. They had frailties. They had weaknesses, just like you and I do. Noah got drunk, had relations with his daughter. Abraham, the father of the faithful, wavered in his faith and lied to the ruler and said that Sarah was his sister. Well, half-sister, it was a half-lie. He didn't have faith that God would give him an heir when God gave him the promise that he was going to give him an heir. Jacob deceived his father into thinking he was Esau. Joseph was rather a prideful, arrogant youth. Moses married the Ethiopian woman. Smote the rock instead of speaking to it. David took Bathsheba, had her husband killed. Sarah didn't trust God would give her a child in her twilight years. Rahab was a harlot. All these people were just like you and I. All imperfect, frail. They fell short. They sinned. Yet God listed them in Hebrews 11. Take a look. Hebrews 11, verse 39. Hebrews 11, verse 39. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise, God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. 12 and verse 1. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Yes, folks, that's the rest of the story. We've been sick. We're in the need of spiritual revival. And you know, like the song says, let there be joy or let there be love and let it begin with me. A spiritual revival is only one person at a time turning to God to be more obedient, to be more diligent, to be more faithful. And that's what we can do. We don't want the penalty, you shall surely die. Jesus Christ did that for us. So if we remain in faith and follow the conditions that God sets out, you know what they are. We need to be on our knees. We need to be repentant. We need to be obedient. Let's not lower the bar. Let's not settle for mediocrity. We can be like the lady caught in sin when Jesus said, I forgive you, but go and sin no more. Let's raise the bar. Let's raise our spiritual bar so we can meet God's standards instead of the world's standards.